the analysis of three great thinkers in that period, that period of chaos or disintegration in the Chinese Empire, the ancient Chinese Empire. Yesterday we finished, you will remember, our all-too-brief look at Lao Tzu and stressed the meaning of the Tao and its implications, for example, for the Lao Tzu, for the Taoist attitude to the state and to authority. We ended by suggesting, someone suggested at the end of the hour, some of you came up to talk about Taoism at the end of the hour, that there is a very close affinity between Taoism in its political attitudes and many modern movements, including, for example, some of Jefferson's statements. Lao Tzu, for example, says in the Tao of Daoxian, that government is best which governs not at all. Jefferson's statement, you will remember, was that government is best which governs least. I don't know whether Jefferson ever read Lao Tzu, but there's a very interesting parallelism between the two. The parallelism between Lao Tzu and a modern writer like Tolstoy on the political side is even more striking. If you, for example, have never read Tolstoy's great novel, Resurrection, which unfortunately we often don't read. We read War and Peace and Anna Karenina and so on, but not Resurrection. You'll get in Resurrection a portrayal of many attitudes which are very strikingly like the Taoist attitude to politics and to law. Now, unfortunately, we have to leave Lao Tzu because we don't have an infinity of time. And to turn to the second great thinker this morning, that is the political theory of Confucius, whose attitude and conception is strikingly different from that of Lao Tzu. And of course, the Confucianists and the Taoists have had a perennial conflict in Chinese thought ever since. We don't know much about the life of Confucius, but what we do know is, or what we think we know, is strikingly illustrative of what his disciples and his intellectual descendants thought he lived like anyway. We can say that. He was born in 551 in Shantung province, which is up in the northern part of China, as you probably remember. And in 551, which would be just a little bit after the fall of Jerusalem, if you want some comparative date in the development of the ancient Hebrews. It is said that at the age of 15, he vowed that he would become a scholar and master all the learning of ancient China, which of course he purportedly did. Because you see, what he does later on in his life is to edit some of the important traditional documents that are handed down from the a remote period. We don't know how far back they go, including the oral traditions involving these documents. The Book of History, the Book of Poetry, the Book of Changes, and so on are all said to have been edited by Confucius. And when you edit an ancient document, of course, you put something of yourself into it. What do you select and what do you reject? You see, from among the documents that claim your attention, somewhat as the Bible was brought together as late as the 2nd century B.C., the Old Testament, at least. So Confucius does the same with the ancient Chinese documents. At any rate, he had to struggle against poverty. The life of Confucius is very much a paradigm, I suppose, for many lives of eminent Americans who start out in log cabins and end up in the White House, except he didn't end up in the White House. He overcame this poverty-stricken background and did indeed become a scholar, accumulating around him, it is said, according to the tradition, some 3,000 students. He attracted the attention of one of the towns in the state of Lu. Lu was one of those feudatory principalities, you remember, that succeeded the empire. As the empire began disintegrating about the middle of the 8th century B.C., and he became a magistrate in this particular town in the, what we usually call the state of Lu. So effective was his magistracy, and we'll see by what method it was effective when we look at his doctrines, that it is said that all the inhabitants of the town left their doors unlocked all the time because there was no one who wanted to steal or to rob. And this attracted the attention, his success as a magistrate in the town attracted the attention of the Duke of Lu, who was the feudatory leader of the state of Lu, who made him then minister of crime, or sometimes we say minister of justice in the state of Lu. There again, Confucius was so successful that it is said that all the jails were empty, that there were no criminals to punish, and they had to close down the jail. And his fame spread throughout the remnants of the ancient empire, provoking jealousy on the part of another feudatory leader, the Duke, I believe it was, of Qin, who began to send rumors back to Lu, to the Duke of Lu, that Confucius was a dangerous character, because he'd emptied the jails and so on. He must have been conspiring against the welfare of the Duke of Lu. Rumors like that came back. Whereupon, finally, the Duke of Lu became suspicious of Confucius. This reminds one very much about the relationship that existed between Plato, for example, the ruler of Syracuse, in Sicily, that I want us to touch on when we look at comparative biographies of the two men. The Duke of Lu became suspicious of Confucius because of these rumors, despite the evidence before him, and he dismissed Confucius. Well, Confucius could not stay in Lu anymore, and therefore he became a wanderer, going around from feudatory to feudatory, seeking to sell his services as an exponent of justice and righteousness, and no one would take him on. This, I guess, is somewhat typical. So he spends the next 13 years of his life in exile from Lu. Again, he accumulates a great many students, but he never gets political power again. Here, he resembles Machiavelli, although he doesn't resemble Machiavelli in any other respect, as far as I can see. The man that we want to deal with, thirdly, Sun Yan, is much closer to a Machiavellian position than Confucius. Well, at the end of his life, he dies in 479. 479 is about the date you see when the ancient Persian wars end, if you want a comparative chronology. By the end of his life, he had accumulated then a great reputation for learning. But political power was further and further away from his grasp. This always, to me, has seemed very symbolical, you see, about the problem of uniting philosophy with rulership. He never does unite them again. And again, there's a close parallel with the development of Plato, in Plato's biography, political biography, to which we want to refer later. Now, we gather the outlook of Confucius from two sources, in a way, the books that he edited, which, you see, are only partly Confucian, presumably. What Confucius does is to give order to an ancient tradition. In a sense, he's the intellectual exponent of a tradition that goes back possibly to the 3rd millennium BC.
he is the late editor of it in that sense, so that in some respects, what he does is not original, but it's a codification of a tradition, although he adds to it himself. And then we have, of course, some of the classical works about Confucius, the report of his sayings written by his disciples, like the Analects, the Book of Li, or the Book of Ceremonies, and the doctrine of the so-called mean, to which we'll be referring in our discussion now. So it's this combination of the two, I suppose you could say, that gives us the materials, and they're very abundant. Whether you can rely on them historically is another question. It gives us the material around which we can build some kind of systematic statement involving his political thought. I might say that there's a continuous tradition in Chinese history from Confucius down to the present day. That is, you'll find thousands of people in contemporary China who will take great pride in the fact that they are direct lineal descendants of Confucius. And the claim is that they can trace their ancestors back directly to documents which have been preserved, which I think is a very interesting highlight on the historicity and the traditional element in Chinese thought. I'd like to divide our discussion in the following way. First of all, to look at the foundations of Confucianism in terms of its doctrine of human nature. And then to see what the implications of that doctrine are for political thought. In terms of human nature, the Book of Li suggests in the teachings of Confucius that man is the product of the attributes of heaven and earth by the interaction of the dual forces of nature, the union of animal and intelligent souls, and the finest subtle matter of the five elements. Man's acts can be interpreted in terms of a struggle between two opposite poles, likes and dislikes. And the political and ethical philosopher then will start out with a description of these two opposing poles, likes and dislikes, and build his conception of man and his conception of man in relationship to society on these two conflicting poles. That is, there's a series of basic desires that you have to come to grips with in human beings. And the three desires, according to Confucius, that are central are the desire to eat, the desire to drink, and the desire for sexual pleasure. Now, what do you do with desire will be one of the questions, of course. Because each of these desires can be almost infinite, see, the Confucianist says. The corresponding dislikes, the opposing poles, are death, exile, poverty, and suffering. And Confucius says that often these desires are concealed desires. They don't come out above. They're stored in our subconscious, in other words. And this creates a difficulty for a person who wants to analyze human personality. Compare that with the modern Freudian account of human nature. Now, building upon these opposing desires, then, Confucius suggests that the central problem is one of restraining desires, limiting desires, and also limiting the possibility of the dislikes, the polar opposites. The problem of governance, therefore, is one of striking a kind of balance between complete expression of desire, which could not take place without destruction, you see, and on the other hand, a recognition that certain dislikes are inevitable. Death is inevitable. We must assume this, for example. Suffering is inevitable. How do you limit the degree of death? How do you limit the degree of suffering? And at the same time, recognize that the basic desires cannot be completely fulfilled. And its sexual desire may take a great many different forms, for example. The original sexual desire may be hidden behind many other kinds of desires, you see. Here you get anticipated in Confucius all those modern theories which think of sex. They're not merely modern. St. Augustine makes sex central too, you see, which becomes a kind of basic thrust or passional thrust that can take many different forms, can be sublimated, as we say. Well, Confucius suggests, try to get back to the original desire from the many forms that sexual desire may take. Conceivably, for example, the desire for aesthetic experience is related somehow to sexual desire. So the problem is of limiting desires and limiting, as insofar as possible, the dislikes or the anti-desires, so to speak, that he enumerates. Both must be taken into consideration. Now, when you do this, you come to Confucius's doctrine of righteousness, which he associates with what he calls the doctrine of the mean. Striking a balance between what would ordinarily be an infinite number of desires, which we can never fulfill, limiting those desires, controlling those desires, and equally keeping in mind the desirability of limiting the dislikes, or the what perhaps in other terms he would call the evils of life. And it is the task of the philosopher then to suggest in the concrete where the mean lies between these two. And I call your attention to this at the very outset, because it's a striking contrast with Lao Tzu's view, you see. Remember, Lao Tzu suggested that desire must be eliminated completely without building up counter-desires in the process, which seems to be a kind of paradoxical thing. You should not desire to suppress desire, Lao Tzu says, and yet desire must be eliminated. Confucius suggests that there is a limit to which you can suppress desire without destroying humanity, so that one must allow the desire vent or expression up to a point, and the philosopher has to decide where that point or that mean is to be. Now, this is what he calls his doctrine of righteousness, you see, that flows from this notion of the two polar opposites struggling in human beings. The second major doctrine which he lays down is that of benevolence, as it's usually translated. Benevolence. Now, there are various ways that those who are acquainted with Chinese philosophy have attempted to suggest the meaning of benevolence in the Confucian system. One thinker I cite his work here, K.C. Wu, a modern scholar on ancient Chinese political theories, suggested benevolence means mutual love. The doctrine of mutuality of love, which would resemble to some degree, you see, the Greek doctrine of philia. On the list of terms that I passed out to you, remember, I suggested various meanings of love and in Greek, and one of them was philia, which is sometimes translated friendship. That is to say, the doctrine of mutual love and friendship will be accompanied or tied to the doctrine of righteousness. And from these two statements, then, Confucius will erect the superstructure, I suppose you could say, of his political thought, which becomes his advice for the governance of the human soul and the governance of the society in which the human soul finds itself. Now, in the process, the great emphasis in Confucius, is on a doctrine that is often ridiculed in the West, and therefore I want to give a rather empathetic account of it to see what Confucius is about when he develops then out of the interrelationship of righteousness and benevolence, he develops then the central notion of propriety. Assuming that the ruler and the philosopher have discovered the mean, you see, and have related righteousness to mutual love or benevolence, what is the doctrine of propriety? Well, broadly speaking, the doctrine of propriety is the conception that you can embody in a kind of permanent way righteousness and benevolence in human beings. How do you do it? Well, you do it through the doctrine of ceremony. So righteousness and benevolence, you see, are bracketed. Out of them comes the doctrine of propriety, and more specifically, out of propriety comes the doctrine of ceremonies. Now, this involves a long kind of explanation, which we don't really have time to do, but I want to spend at least 3 or 4 minutes on trying to convey the spirit of what propriety and ceremonies mean in the Confucian scheme of things. In the doctrine of the mean, Confucius is said to have said this: the decreasing measures of the love do various grades of relatives, and the different ranks of honor due to the diverse degrees of worthiness are produced by the principle of propriety. Now let's see what propriety means as a reflection, as it is reflected in the doctrine of ceremonies. First, the doctrine of propriety. He carries over from traditional Chinese thought the notion that the way to overcome the chaos of history is for the ruler to set the example. This is embedded in Chinese thought far back before Confucius. At one place he says, for example, that the ruler cannot rule the community unless he can first rule himself and his family. And by ruling himself, he means, of course, the correct combination of righteousness and benevolence in his own personal life. Confucius has very little confidence in ruling by precept.
You have to rule by example. In reference to yourself, where contesting passions are at work, in reference to your family, and of course a great emphasis is placed upon the importance of the family, and finally in reference to the state. Now you notice here there's a very basic problem, a very basic issue. The authority of the ruler in this notion, this conception, arises not out of impersonal law or organization. He becomes authoritative for others only insofar as he has mastered himself and acts benevolence and righteousness. He becomes authoritative only when he enacts in his own actions benevolence and righteousness. I stress this very much because you see, in Western political theory, we're going to have a constant battle, in a way. You get it, for example, in medieval political theory, between the problem of whether authority arises out of personal righteousness or whether it arises out of social arrangements, you see, in some way, in an impersonal way. Well, Confucius lands on the first side very strongly. You cannot expect to be authoritative as a ruler unless you yourself exemplify to the highest degree righteousness and benevolence. This is known, as I said the other day, in traditional Chinese thought as the theory of exemplary kingship. Theory of exemplary kingship. And we'll see corresponding problems as we get into Greek political theory and Christian political theory, with differing answers on this point. And thus the Confucian would say that Confucius was successful in his town when he was director of police, and in Lu when he was minister of crime. He was successful because of his personal character, not because he had an array of armored tanks or because he had an authority conferred on him by the prince. This was relatively minor. His success came from his personal righteousness and benevolence. Let me quote from a supposed dialogue that Confucius had with a questioner. You see, this is often the way that Confucian teaching is handed down when you get the edited books here about Confucius. Chi Ta Kong Tzu asked Confucius about government. Confucius replied, "To govern is to rectify. If you lead the people with uprightness, who does not be, who dares not be upright?" Again, Chi Kong Tzu asked him about government. "What do you say to killing the unprincipled for the good of the principled?" See the old question. And Confucius' response was to this question, "Why should you use killing at all? Let your desires be for what is good, and the people will be good. The relationship between superiors and inferiors is like that between the wind and the grass. The grass must bend when the wind blows across it." Now we can interpret this in modern terminology, I suppose, by saying that the Confucian teaching is that the greatest power for righteousness and justice and benevolence in the state is opinion. And the way to get that opinion molded is to have individuals who exemplify to the nth degree, you see, in their personality, the principles of righteousness and benevolence. See, the problem turns historically, and it's a very old problem that we'll see coming up in connection with the life of St. Augustine next term. Rises in somewhat the following way. Ought you to obey me as a ruler because I have legal legitimacy? I'm constitutional, no matter what my personal character is. And some say yes. And of course, if you look at the history of rulership in back to the ancients, you'll see that a very high percentage of all rulers have been personal scoundrels. That's a very high percentage. I don't know. I've never conducted a Gallup poll on that point. But it's striking that from the days of Confucius to the present day, this has been true. I don't exempt 1972. The other answer to that problem, and of course, the other answer to that problem is that you should obey primarily because the ruler embodies in his person universal principles of righteousness and benevolence. This is the only ground, then, whereby you regard yourself as an inferior. You regard yourself as an inferior in terms of righteousness and benevolence. And you take the cue from the person who has the most righteousness and benevolence. Now, incidentally, he may have the roles of official authority put on him, too. That's in addition. Or as we say, he performs a social role, the sociologist would say. But unless he combines that social role with personal righteousness and benevolence, Confucius is making both a statement of fact and a statement of value. The statement of fact is the tendency will be for people not to obey him unless he embodies a high degree of righteousness and benevolence. And the statement of value is that somehow they ought not to obey him unless he embodies in his person a high degree of benevolence and righteousness. Now, it's from this notion of exemplary kingship, then, that you move on to the doctrines of propriety and ceremony. Obedience is possible only when the ruler exemplifies righteousness and benevolence. What then is the notion of ceremony? Well, the problem is for the ruler to embody the doctrines of righteousness and ceremonies in external form. In other words, once he sets the example, how do you get individuals habitually to obey the example? You do it. And this is what rubs Westerners the wrong way, according to most critics of Confucius. You do it by trying to embody in great detail the implications of righteousness and benevolence in what we translate as ceremony. That is, the relationships between superior and inferior, and how they ought to behave to one another. You work it out in great detail, for example. What a child owes to his parents. What a subject owes to his rulers. What equals owe to each other. You see, it works horizontally, too. And you, so that you are not kept guessing. If you live in a society, you're not kept guessing as to what your duties are at a given moment. The duties are prescribed for you by what we might call the ethical code made habitual, propriety and ceremonies. It is not meet, let's say, for a son not to show respect to his father. It is not meet for a subject not to show respect to the ruler who exemplifies righteousness and benevolence. And how do you show respect? Well, here then you work out the kinds of external acts which supposedly reflect an internal spirit. What do you do when you eat? Well, how should you eat? How should you pay taxes? How should you protest? All these things are worked out in great detail so that the individual is not constantly worried about what his obligations are at a given moment. The ruler then can continue his rulership, and the subject can be a good subject through this development of ceremonies, as you might, as it is often called. Now, notice behind this idea of ceremonial hierarchical relationships, which is not law, you see. It's not law in the sense that the ceremony is more than law, in a way. Confucius is not against law, the principle of law. But he thinks law is a fragile thing. It has to be built upon habitual ethical action, based ultimately, again, on righteousness and benevolence. It's only then that law has any effect. This carries out, of course, the Confucian principle that public opinion is perhaps the most powerful factor in the ordering of a society. But one of the criticisms, of course, that has been directed, immemorial, this is one of the criticisms that the Taoists throw at the Confucianists, for example, is, aren't the ceremonies simply external and do not involve an internal desire, you see, for righteousness and benevolence? The answer that the Confucianists give, I think, is very interesting from the viewpoint of modern social psychology. One answer they give is that often we need to perform external acts, what seem to be purely external acts, before we can understand their implications for internal attitudes. And as you move from the outside inward, the right internal acts, or the right internal attitudes, which after all is the basis for governance, are developed only through external acts, are largely through external acts. That's the beginning point. The analogy would be in the development of the child. The child is told, when you show respect for your parents by not sassing them back, or whatever the principle is. And initially the child obeys, presumably simply because the principle is given to him by his parents. Later on, as he reaches adolescence and begins the process of individualization, he begins to meditate then, you see, on this external, these external marks of respect. Don't interfere when your parent is talking. Don't break into him. Principles of this sort, you see. He begins to meditate on the external acts. And as he meditates on them, he begins to see their reason. He begins to see their reason. And as he begins to see their reason, or their basis in rationality, he then, as we say in the contemporary jargon, internalizes his morality. Internalizes his morality, which is the only way that morality can be effective in either personal life or in political life. Well, the ceremonies, the ceremonial precepts then of the Confucianists have this design in mind. They dramatize the issues of righteousness and benevolence in external ceremonies in order that the individual will then be able to make them habitual out of internal motivations.